Hey there, listeners. Galen here. Before we begin, I wanted to let you know that this episode was actually supposed to air last week while I was on vacation, but it got moved because of all of the impeachment news. I know that impeachment is at the top of everyone's mind right now, and this episode is not specifically about impeachment, but it's about the media and television and how those affect public opinion and therefore our politics. And that's still going to be relevant as we move through this impeachment inquiry, so we still thought it was worth airing. Here you go. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we spend a good amount of time talking about political media narratives on this podcast, whether they're based in evidence or not, and how they can shape public opinion. So today, we're going to take a look at how media narratives and the media itself have changed over the past 40 years. And we're going to do that with the chief television critic at the New York Times, James Poniewozik. Hello, James. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me.
And James just wrote a book that argues that TV's evolution from three main networks to the atomized landscape of today helps explain our politics, our country, and Donald Trump. And his book is called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. So I have a lot of questions for you, great, which we'll get to. But first, I want to just start by letting you flesh out your thesis a little bit more for us. So why are the evolution of TV and our politics so linked?
I start from the premise that television is the nervous system of America and American democracy. And it's the forum through which politics is carried out and through a lot of public life. And if you want to understand public life in America, you need to understand how TV works. In this particular book, the thing that I am posing to myself is, how did we get to the point where the guy from The Apprentice could become president? And that is as much a TV story as it is a politics story. I open with a very early interview, TV interview, that Donald Trump did with Rona Barrett, the gossip columnist, about, I believe it was called Rona Barrett Looks at America's Super Rich. And she interviewed a bunch of business people and wealthy people, one of whom was the young Manhattan real estate scion, Donald Trump. And she asks him, has the presence of mind to ask him at that time if he would ever want to run for president. And he says he would not. And one of the reasons that he gives is that he believes that television has ruined the process, so that somebody with controversial, perhaps unpopular ideas and an unpopular presentation would lose out to somebody who has a great, big, friendly smile. Cut to the year 2015. Donald Trump, former star of The Apprentice and longtime Fox News personality, is appearing on Fox and Friends and about to announce the next day his run for the presidency. One of the co-hosts asks him, well, won't it be a problem? Your abrasive personality, you're known for being controversial. Will this necessarily play in a general election electorate? And he says, well, I don't think this is going to be a contest based on real popularity. And the thing that I'm thinking is, he's not wrong either time. Back in 1980, a figure like Donald Trump probably could not win a presidential election in the format of American television, which at the time was a broad mainstream medium where you had big audiences and the tone of the medium needed to be calibrated so that everything that you presented was broadly palatable. What changed over time was that by the time that Donald Trump has become a reality TV star and a figure on Fox News, you have a fragmented media, thousands of channels, lots of social media channels and so forth, which makes for a fragmented audience and rewards more provocative, polarizing programming.
How did that happen? How did we go from 1980s three network television, kind of the birth of CNN, but that comes within the 80s,
yeah,
to this fragmented media landscape that Trump entered in 2015?
I mean, it's partly a business change. It is the development of cable, which means more players, which means that ultimately everything that's on the air has a smaller and smaller audience. And television is a medium in which the business often determines the content. When you have smaller audiences, number one, you move from this programming toward what used to be called the least objectionable program, where you just didn't want to give people a reason to change the channel, toward programming that targets specific audiences, channels for young people, channels for sports fans, channels for the news audience, and so forth. And you get an increase in demographic programming, people targeting certain age groups and certain affinity groups and so forth. And all of that means that programming becomes more and more specialized. Suddenly you have outlets arising like HBO, which have a smaller audience that pays to get the channel and wants programming that might turn a lot of people off, but that they will affirmatively subscribe to. So you can put something on the air like The Sopranos, a mobster show which asks you to root for and follow, in many ways, a very unlikable but charismatic antihero that you could not have put on the air, not just for content reasons, but for sort of the philosophical reason of, you know, making the viewer root for the bad guy. You couldn't have had that on the air in an earlier era of television.
So which came first, the fracturing of American society or the fracturing of American media?
I think they tend to work in tandem. You know, society is, you know, the story of the collapse of whatever post-war consensus there is a long political story. And obviously you can talk about the turmoil in America in the 60s and the 70s, which begins to be reflected in some ways in popular culture. You know, you start getting the comedies of Norman Lear and All in the Family and so forth. But the fragmenting of the media is an accelerant, I think, in many ways, because it makes possible these formats in which you're just communicating to a particular sector. It makes possible the development of things ultimately like Fox News, where you have a particular political segment that's getting programming that is simply aimed at them and reaffirming their worldview.
So it's not necessarily that a fractured American society caused a fractured media or that a fractured media caused a fractured American society. They could be the byproduct of larger political forces, but the media is really, like you said, throwing gasoline on the fire.
Yeah, exactly. And it is able to adapt itself to and serve this fragmented culture with fragmented offerings.
I'm always curious, when we put so much emphasis on the role of cable news, you know, good ratings, great ratings in primetime cable news is like having 3 million viewers, right? That's what Sean Hannity gets,
right,
for example. That is such a small percentage of the American public. How can that kind of programming have such a big effect on American politics and society more broadly?
For one thing, cable news's audiences are small, but they're cumulative. So a cable channel that may only have a couple million people watching at any point in time may have many more watching in aggregate over the course of the day. Number two, because there is so much of this programming, it just becomes a much greater part of the TV news corpus. So a lot more political argument is going on through them, as opposed to, you know, the old broadcast networks, which used to air Sunday shows and, you know, a half hour of national news in the evening and so forth. So they just have a much bigger footprint and therefore a bigger influence in the national discourse. Now, what does that influence create content-wise? What's different about cable news and broadcast news besides cable news just being more of it? Well, because of the business model of cable news, it's 24-hour. And it has to create the idea that there is news, that there's something to be excited about, even when there isn't something actually happening, right? And so, therefore, we see an emphasis on sensation and on conflict and shows where, you know, you're getting one person from the left to argue with somebody on the right. It's creating sensation and excitement even where none exists, because that creates the impetus to tune in. And that kind of changes the metabolism of the news, and it changes the tone of the news, and therefore it changes the tone of the rhetoric that's carried out through the news.
In the opening of your book, you say that journalists have undervalued the role that television played in Trump's political success. So how do you see that role? What's the proper way to view the relationship between television and Trump's political success?
I mean, Donald Trump wasn't a businessman who happened to become a celebrity. He was a celebrity who leveraged celebrity into business. Media stardom wasn't an ancillary or secondary effect of his pursuits it was the point of him. He said early on in his career that, you know, I'm going to go into real estate, but I'm going to put show business into real estate. He had this realization as sort of a creature of the media, a child of television, that what appeared on a screen, the symbolic importance of that, was much more important than actual reality. It was more important to appear like people's notion of rich, spectacularly successful New York businessman than it was necessarily to actually be the most successful businessman in New York, because that seeming is something that you can leverage and it builds your brand and you can parlay that into success in other fields. I feel that, I mean, as you know, after Trump won the 2016 election, there were a lot of how did we get Trump explainers, but they tended to focus on either sort of a glib interpretation of, you know, it's this crazy reality show that we live in now, or they would treat his media success as something that was secondary to his other pursuits. But I think television and more largely this notion of creating yourself in the sphere of American illusion, that was always the primary point of him. Not just talking about The Apprentice, not just talking about Fox News, but going back to his earliest days as a public figure in the 80s.
What we're talking about here, right, is symbolism, and that's been important in politics for a really long time. You have Bill Clinton playing the saxophone, you have Reagan being a cowboy, Obama's hope posters, and you can look at this cycle and see the makings of it with Uncle Joe and Elizabeth Warren's Got a Plan, right? Because politics is so complicated and because they're feeding their vision of the country through the media, everything gets kind of flattened into these symbols. Is Donald Trump all that different from the symbols we've had in politics dating back to maybe the start of television?
I mean, I think that one thing that is important was that he didn't have to have symbols crafted for him by a media guru. You know, his existence was the creation of symbolism. He, you know, long before he was a political figure, he saw his life as a performance. He would talk about the yacht he bought from Adnan Khashoggi or his, you know, helicopter with his name on the side of him as props for the show being, you know, Donald Trump, creating the symbolic perception of yourself, of sort of using figurative language and appearance to stand for something larger that hits people on a gut level. This was not something that he sort of had to have grafted onto his persona once he was pursuing an audience. He was native to this. You know, he had been doing this as his main public endeavor since, you know, before ground was broken on Trump Tower.
You say, in fact, that you're writing about Trump, the TV character, not Trump, the person.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Donald Trump, the person, you know, is a human being who has walked the earth and has a childhood and psychology and motivations. And, you know, is the person that people talk about when they still fixate on the notion of, well, who is Donald Trump really? Does he do these things, you know, intentionally or instinctively? But Donald Trump, the character, the media performance, the image who has walked across our TV screens since the 1980s is not a character in the sense that a movie actor plays a character, say, but it is the performed self. It's a character the way that you play a character when you're on a reality TV show, which is to say you're yourself, but more. You exaggerate the parts of yourself that get attention. You exaggerate the parts of yourself that create controversy, the aspects of yourself that will get you into the edit of the show rather than landing on the cutting room floor.
I mean, what you're describing right now kind of sounds like campaigning.
Yeah.
Right? Like, is politics just the same as a TV show at this point?
I mean, you can argue that politics has always been, you know, it's always had an element of stagecraft. And in a TV era, there has always been a significant element of managing your presentation in television and in the media. I don't think that Donald Trump necessarily changed that. It didn't change that politics is about performance. It didn't change that politics is about symbol. But it reaffirmed that this had become so powerful that you didn't need to, you know, say, go from a performance career like Ronald Reagan did, serve two terms as governor of California, and then eventually rise in the party and run for president. You could go directly from hosting the Celebrity Apprentice to running 4 months later for president and win.
In talking about how politics is performance and symbolism, is that a product itself of television? You know, not just focusing on Trump specifically, but going back to, say, the 40s or 50s, do you see a clear relationship between the emergence of television and politics and the kinds of things that are emphasized in campaigning and maybe even governing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, nothing is new under the sun. Before television existed, candidates played up their biographies and created characters as, you know, the rail splitter, you know, or whatever. That, you know, isn't something that was invented by television. But television changes American politics the way it changes a lot of American society, in that it makes it image-centric. Once television exists, there is suddenly a virtual space that exists in everybody's living rooms that didn't before. And so running for office was not just about making a textual argument, you know, advancing a platform, having slogans, having certain rhetoric, but it was about your presentation, sort of serving as like a metonym for the idea of your candidacy. So that if you go into a debate, it's not just what you say in the debate, but it's how you appear and the way that you debate that sort of sends a visual message about, here's the type of president that I will be. So you have John F. Kennedy going on TV in the 1960 debates against Richard Nixon and appearing more vital and attractive. And that not only simply makes him, quote unquote, look better than Richard Nixon in the classic story of how television undermined Nixon in that first run, but it resonates with this message of his campaign as being about youth, about vitality, about the future, about the new frontier. You know, it doesn't invent symbolism, but it certainly enhances the importance of visual symbolism because we're suddenly in a visual culture. You know, word has given way to the image, and that's what we're about now.
I want to continue this conversation in just a minute, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35. And once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims is helping guys be the best version of themselves with licensed physicians and FDA-approved products to help treat hair loss. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, just prescription solutions backed by science. 4hims connects you to real doctors online, which could save you hours, and it's completely confidential and discreet. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 right now while supplies last. Also subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's 4hims, FORHIMS.com/538. 4hims.com/538. All right, we're back, and we were talking a bit about how TV has changed what gets emphasized in American politics. So I kind of just want to ask you bluntly, after reading your book, it's kind of pessimistic about the role that television has played in American politics. So do you think that TV has harmed American democracy?
I mean, we've had bad presidents before television. We've had, you know, dispiriting campaigns before television. I don't know that it has harmed American democracy, but it has changed the playing field. It has made it important to have a showbiz aspect to running for president, to appeal to people on more of a gut level and more of a sort of visual and metaphoric level. I don't think that's inherently bad. Like, I don't want to, you know, send the message that I feel that, you know, television has sent the country to hell and dumbed us down and so on, because I'm not necessarily sure that that is true across the board. Reaching people on a gut level, moving people, having sort of, you know, a sense of theater and being able to inspire people is an important part of persuasion. I think that probably the most pernicious effect that TV has had has been less directly in campaigns, but in sort of exacerbating with other players in the media the sense of intense political camps who don't listen to each other and simply hear their own worldviews reified for them and kind of exists in an entirely different headspace than other people in the country exist.
How does TV journalism or television make that happen? Making it feel like people in America live in basically different realities.
I would extend this beyond TV to today, social media, internet news, and so forth, talk radio. It allows you to seek out environments and news outlets that affirm your pre-existing beliefs. I think there were a lot of problems with the old, you know, three network model of television. It was homogenizing and it often shut out a lot of marginalized groups and perspectives and so forth. One thing that it did do, though, was have people from a lot of different American walks of life exposed to the same sort of thing and accept, you know, it's the same general fact base. I think that that's something that we've lost. I think another thing that you see that is particular to television and the way television communicates is what Neil Postman talks about in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. It had a sensibility that he described as now this, which refers to the segue that a news anchor will use when they're transitioning from, you know, a story about a Middle East summit to a story about, you know, squirrel on water skis, right? It's like this non sequitur. There's no narrative. And it discourages this sort of more long form discourse that, you know, lays out evidence and builds an argument to this thing, this thing, this thing, this thing, and this thing. And cable news is, you know, now this, but accelerated. It's this, 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 this. It's anti-argument. It's just one incitement after another, after another. And you know, that tempo, that sort of constantly agitating sensibility is, you know, definitely something that cable news has imposed on our media environment.
And of course, Trump comes into this environment and is able to, you know, appeal to at least a plurality of Republicans in the primary and go on to win that nomination and win the presidency. I'm curious, though, in reading this, it made me think, you know, as much as Trump's made-for-TV style seems to have gotten him to where he is, it seems pretty discordant with a lot of Americans. His polling, his approval rating is not good. The first referendum on his presidency, the midterms, Republicans were creamed. And Republicans are now losing some of the people who are most likely to show up and vote in elections, which is college-educated voters. So do you think that this trend of the made-for-TV anti-hero, as you describe Trump, will continue? It doesn't seem like people are embracing the made-for-TV anti-hero part of Trump's presidency.
Yeah, I kind of describe Trump in TV terms as he's a program that lost the total audience but won in the demo, right? Like in TV, you can be a hit by super serving an advertising demographic that pulls in bucks for commercials while having a lower total audience than your opponent. That's sort of analogous to, you know, a political campaign in which you super serve a base and you happen to like hit the trifecta and do that in enough of the right places that you win the Electoral College while losing the popular vote. That also means that, you know, Trump's in a situation now where a media strategy, a sort of a media performance that he's been rewarded for over and over again, being pugilistic, being antagonistic, fighting, you know, just sort of promoting the war of all against all, that really excites his base, but it leaves him, you know, as you have talked about at 538 in many other contexts, with little margin for error. Like, he can't lose that many people and still win another election, and he's not acting like somebody who wants to add to that. Now, does that mean, you know, if I don't know if he's going to get reelected or not, but if he doesn't get reelected, does that mean that, you know, he's just an aberration and this never happens again? I don't think that. I also don't think that this means that the only way you become president is by going to war and being an anti-hero. I simply think that it means that there is this other path to becoming president now that didn't used to exist before.
I'm curious, from the TV critic's perspective, what are you taking note of in the Democratic primary so far? Have any of the candidates learned from Trump's strategy?
I think that there is a meta debate going on in the Democratic primary about how you respond to Trump. There's this definite consciousness, and I think it's, you know, reflected in the anxiety of a lot of the Democratic electorate of, you know, how do you possibly beat Trump? Of how do you respond to somebody who, through his, you know, Twitter account and his symbiosis with Fox News, is able to make himself the star of this 24-hour news show every day and command the you know, obsession of the media? And it seems like there's two schools of thought, right? There's the turn the channel off school of thought, and there's the counter program school of thought, right? The first one, Joe Biden, I think, is the biggest exemplar of this, is that you rely on the assumption that people are worn out and that the Trump show has been overexposed. And you want to give them the promise that, like, just elect me and you just won't have to look at your damn phone with anxiety first thing in the morning for at least another 4 years. And the other side is this notion that you have to be able to sort of create excitement and tell an affirmative story. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean trying to beat Trump at his own game, but it does mean recognizing that, you know, politics is pop culture now in a lot of ways, and that you have to be able to compete in this arena. And, you know, I think candidates have gone about that in different ways. You know, you referred to Elizabeth Warren, you know, I've got a plan for that, which, you know, again, is not just a matter of having a lot of policy proposals. It's a way of branding them in a way that sort of sends a larger message about, you know, who you are as a president, and gives you, it makes you a character with a catchphrase, you know, which is not an unpowerful thing in politics today. So I think that that's the big debate that I see going on. Do, you know, can you replace something with nothing, basically?
Are there other politicians that you see as particularly keyed into the instincts of a television audience other than Trump?
I think AOC is a good example. She may also be a very good example of the next thing, which is, you know, she has a very strong instinct for social media, going beyond Twitter, her use of Instagram, you know, and so forth. Obviously, social media has been very important to Donald Trump, but it is important in part because it gets you on TV. It allows you to sort of be the programmer of your own show and kind of set the agenda and drive coverage of you. So I think AOC is a very good example of that. At one point, Beto O'Rourke had been, and he seems to have had a hard time adapting that to, for probably a lot of reasons, some of which go beyond television, to the general election campaign. You know, oddly, I could see, it's not necessarily, quote unquote, technically, you know, an elected political figure now, I could see Donald Trump Jr. being a Donald Trump of the future, because he so grasps how much of the Republican politics in the era of his father, politics in general in the era of his father, is about trolling your enemies.
You mentioned this transition to social media, and I was looking at some Pew data earlier today. In 2016, 57% of Americans got their news often from TV, and that was the most common source. In 2018, that number was down to 49%. And the numbers for news websites and social media keep rising. I mean, I think the conventional wisdom is that TV is dying. So how will the effects of media on our politics, do you think, change as things shift away from TV and more towards potentially even more atomized social media and news websites?
It will probably take a few elections before we start seeing this effects, because I still think that the continuing hold on TV is something that you're not going to be able to ignore for a while. But it might have the effect of making it possible for more candidates to emerge outside of the, you know, traditional ideological lanes of their parties. Certainly, you know, a lot of the kinds of candidates that you see bubbling up in the, you know, presidential primaries that, you know, who have strength in social media and so forth, they've been people like, you know, say Andrew Yang today, who, you know, has, you know, very much been an internet phenomenon, who was not necessarily getting much TV coverage at all in the early parts of his campaign. And now that might not be enough for somebody like him, who you can't necessarily throw in, you know, a particular ideological box like we're used to them. It might not be enough for him to get the nomination this time, but, you know, the next Andrew Yang maybe you know, gets 20%, and, you know, the next one after that maybe gets the nomination.
Yeah, it's funny that you mention that more people from outside of the traditional ideological lanes might bubble up, because in reading your book, I'm thinking, you know, in a presidential election, you have to win 60 to 70 million votes.
Yeah.
And in this atomized media environment where people are basically living in their own little media realities along with, say, 3 million other people or 500,000 other people, how do you build a coalition of 60 to 70 million people when our realities are so atomized?
In one sense, you sort of do it by fiat, you know, because enough people recognize that whether they like it or not, they have essentially two choices in a presidential election, you know, and I think that that was part of the reason for Donald Trump's success in 2016 when, you know, he got to the general election. I think that, you know, even a lot of people who thought he might win the Republican primary thought, well, surely, you know, a figure this outrageous is not going to win the general. Because, you know, you're right. It's like you go from the primary, which is cable television, to the general election, which is sort of like, you know, broadcast television codified into the Constitution. And, you know, as it turned out, there was enough partisan loyalty and other factors to carry Donald Trump over the top. You know, the mechanics of politics may force a sizable coalition together one way or another, but those coalitions tend to be more fractious and more unhappy because you have this disconnect between the messaging that they're getting from every part of media that, you know, they deal with in every part of their lives, which is that, you know, they have an exaggerated sense of how many other people share their exact views because they're hearing them reinforced over and over again. And then they go into the election and it's, well, Coke or Pepsi, you know, too bad, you know, and it sort of creates it. Number one. Okay. So it creates this disconnect. It creates these people dissatisfied. Well, you know, I get all these signals that tell me that, you know, there's this vast number of people who believe exactly that I believe. And now you're suddenly saying that I have to water this down and you're kind of like distancing yourselves from me. You know, what the hell is wrong with you? And it makes people, you know, in some cases more susceptible to a figure like Donald Trump, who part of his appeal to the GOP base was, you know, I am wholly of you. I believe all your stuff. I even believe the birther stuff. You know, I don't distance myself from you and hold you with tongs and treat you like a crazy cousin the way John McCain did and Mitt Romney did. So, you know, for somebody like that, that's sort of something that you can leverage this dissonance between the base of your party and the things that your party does to try to appeal to general election audiences.
It's hard for me not to think as I'm listening to you say all of this about we're part of the media ecosystem right now and like what number of people get their, you know, news or analysis from 538 and how does that shape their world? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess, you know, subscribe to a few other podcasts and
no, only listen to 538. Well, anyway, I think that's about it for me. You know, I'm always curious. I know you spent so much time researching this book. What's the most surprising thing that you uncovered throughout the process?
You know, the most eye-opening thing to me, and this is something that, you know, I sort of guiltily feel I should have been more aware of, but even as somebody who covers TV and covers cable news for a living, I really, until I delved into the internet TV archives, was not aware of the extent to which Donald Trump was a presence on Fox News during the years that he was a Celebrity Apprentice host before he ran for president. He had a weekly call-in on Fox and Friends for 4 years, Mondays with Trump, before he ran for president. He was talked about on the network and sort of cultivated and transitioned from being an entertainment figure to being a political figure for years and years. You know, it was really kind of his handmaiden to running for president because, you know, Roger Ailes spent years and years cultivating this audience that he got to imprint on Fox and trust only it and not the rest of the biased, corrupt media. And then Donald Trump came in and swiped that audience and got them to imprint on him and even take his side over Fox when he feuded with Fox during the primary. I think the extent to which and the pervasiveness of which Donald Trump was a presence on Fox, I think we've all underestimated it. I think that Fox News probably did as much to elect him as The Apprentice did.
Interesting. And how do you see that relationship right now?
I think that Fox News is beholden to Donald Trump. Well, it's two things. Donald Trump originally depended on Fox News for access to its audience, and that power balance shifted so that now Fox News depends on Donald Trump to get access to its audience, which is, you know, I think part of the reason that Fox News has, with, you know, maybe the occasional exception, gone so obsequiously all in on Donald Trump. On the other hand, you know, Fox News very much calls the tune for Donald Trump in many ways, intentionally and not, simply because Donald Trump is as much an addictive consumer of television as he is a user of it. So, you know, we have this phenomenon where he gets up in the morning and he watches Fox and Friends and he watches his Lou Dobbs on TiVo and he gets mad and he tweets and the tweets become news and then he reacts to that news. It very much sets his agenda. So while Fox News has sort of lost its audience to Donald Trump, in many ways, it has also become Donald Trump's brain.
All right. Well, I think we'll leave things there. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks a lot, Galen.
I've been speaking with James Poniewozik. He is the chief television critic at the New York Times, and his book is called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.